Hey, buddy.
What's going on?
Yeah.
Can I ask about closing an electric coffee machine?
Yeah.
Yeah, I heard one of my friends was told that he has to put the whole machine into the loofah, into the electronic machine, and then let it dry for a week. Is there any other...
Well, that is the best thing to do. In fact, he may have, I don't know if he asked me or not, that's what I would tell a person.
Okay.
But there are, I mean, there are, there's a lot of discussion over this. I mean, some poskim take the position that electrical appliances do not have to be immersed in a mikveh because when they are connected to the wall,
yes,
as opposed to a battery, they're called mechubar lekarka, and karka does not require to be, there is such a svara like that. Others have a svara that if it's used to heat water,
yes,
so since water is royally achila even before you cook it,
yes,
so therefore it's not something that is, unlike a pot which cooks food like potatoes, water, things that heat water are not called kli suda because they don't convert it from the inedible to the edible. So those are two svaras why you wouldn't have to be tovel. However, most poskim say you should be tovel it, and indeed just not using it for a week or so, or even drying it out with a hairdryer, would in fact avoid the danger. In fact, it would be okay. In other words, there are different opinions, but most poskim do say to be tovel it.
What about I heard one about taking it apart and then putting it back.
Yes, that's a third thing. Now, that already is a bit more complicated. It depends how mechanical you are. That is, if you take it apart in such a way that an average person wouldn't be able to put it together again, you need some type of expertise, then it's no longer a kli. So when you make it a kli, it became a kli in the Yisrael's Rishus. So there's no chiyuv of tevila because only something that was a kli bought from a goy requires tefillah.
So we're taking off a plug suffice, or is that too simple?
No, it's just taking off the plug?
Yeah, putting it back
on. I'm not sure, but you know, you take off the plug, you mean remove the...
Yeah, you take off the plug so that it doesn't work, and then by putting it back. But is that most the average person...
That might be, if the average person can do it,
yeah,
then it wouldn't be good enough, right? It has to be something that requires a certain measure of skill.
Is one permitted to talk between my Achron intervention?
One is not supposed to talk in Achron intervention. That is a halacha in Shulchan Aruch. But it's not going to be stricter, of course, than between the Tila Shadayim and Hamotzi. So the types of interruptions that are permitted there, which aren't that many, in fact, some of them wouldn't apply. You could say bring the salt or something like that. But the analogy would be anything that's relevant to benching. If you were to say bring the benchers or something like that, that would not be a hepsik, but you should not talk. Yeah.
Welcome back, first of all. two-part question. A few weeks ago, we went out for Shabbos, and our host was talking about how you can only accomplish certain things if you daven Nusach Svard. And I mentioned to him that I heard a tshuva from Moshe that if you daven Nusach Ashkenaz, you should not swap over. First of all, I want to check the validity that such a tshuva exists. And second of all, the host then claimed that it is inappropriate to paskin Makrof Moshe because he didn't learn Kabbalah. So I want to know what you think about that.
Now, listen, that alone, you should not go to that host again. That alone, I mean, the other stuff is the other stuff, but someone that's Mavaze, go to Lador, you know, I really, that's a very, very serious, that's a very, very serious thing. I don't take that lightly at all. But in terms of this is Mavaze, Talmud Chacham is Ein Lo Chelek Lo Maba. But, again, I hope everyone gets Olam Haba, but this is how serious it is. But in terms of the Etzem Inyan, you know, what you're going to find is, you're going to find that Sephardic Poskim will say that you cannot change from Sephard to Ashkenaz, but the other way is perfectly okay. And you will find Ashkenazic Poskim that say, you know, it's okay to go from Sephard to Ashkenaz. In other words, Ashkenazic Poskim talk about the superiority of Ashkenaz, and Sephardim talking about the opposite. But let me just mention this. Let me just mention the following idea. The Nusach Ashkenaz is actually historically the old Nusach of Eretz Yisrael, dating from the Yerushalmi and earlier. The Nusach Sfarad is actually the Nusach of the Jews in Babylonia. So in some sense, one could make the argument that halachically, Nusach Sfarad is more valid based on the principle that in the Machlokas, the Bavli and the Yerushalmi, we normally follow the Bavli, right? That's kind of a strange thing. And yet, Nusach Ashkenaz is an older Nusach, and in these Inyanim, it says each person should follow his Minog. Now, let me just explain that Nusach Sfarad is a bit more complicated than Nusach Ashkenaz for the following reasons. Initially, as the Nuschos diverged, Yerushalmi, Bavli, etc. So what you had was, Nusach Ashkenaz was Germany, Poland, Russia, Lithuania, France. Nusach Sfarad was primarily North Africa, which we call Eidot HaMizrach. So there never was a concept that Jews from Eastern and Central Europe daven Nusach Sfarad at all. I mean, in fact, it makes no sense. Nusach Sfarad means the Spanish and North African Nusach. So how did some Ashkenazim daven Nusach Sfarad? That dates only from the time of the Arizal onwards. The Arizal developed all sorts of inyanim of Kabbalah, and the Arizal took Nusach Sfarad as his base to develop these Kabbalistic Nuschais. So when Hasidim in Eastern Europe began to popularize the Nusach of the Ari, they brought along Nusach Sfarad. So that's why you have two types of Nusach Sfarad. You have the Nusach Sfarad of Eidot HaMizrach, which historically that was their Nusach. And then you have the Nusach Sfarad of Hasidim, which was actually superimposed on a Nusach Ashkenaz. Another way of putting it is, Nusach Sfarad of Hasidim is really a variation of Nusach Ashkenaz to incorporate the Kavanas of the Arizal. So when Hasidim made that change, that was an extraordinarily controversial issue that was opposed by a person who did know Kabbalah, named the Vilna Gaon. The Vilna Gaon said that, in fact, Hasidim had no halachic right to change from their ancestral Nusach, meaning, you understand what I'm saying? In other words, Nusach Sfarad and Nusach Eidot HaMizrach, although they're very similar, in fact, are very different. Eidot HaMizrach, this was their Nusach. Hasidim took Nusach Ashkenaz and changed it to follow the Kavanas of the Arizal. Now, the Chasam Sofer writes in a tshuva that in point of fact, all of the Kabbalistic Kavanas of the Arizal apply equally to Ashkenaz and Sfarad. And the only reason the Ari wrote his Kavanas in Nusach Sfarad is only because that happened to have been the Nusach he davened in. So he developed his Kavanas. But since both are from a Makam Kadesh, Chasam Sofer, who also knew Kabbalah, did incorporate, in other words, said that the Kavanas apply equally. So this is an important corrective, because people think that the Kabbalistic Kavanas of the Ari only applied in Nusach Sfarad. That is not true, the Chasam Sofer says. He happened to write it on Nusach Sfarad because he was simply using his Siddur, which, by the way, also teaches a new thing. The Ari did not invent a Nusach. The Ari just took the Siddur he davened in, and he developed these Kavanas. But these Kavanas would apply equally to Nusach Ashkenaz.
And that's what it came. I mean, we can assume Rav Moshe knew Kodakur, right?
Yes. But did he study Kabbalah systematically? You know, I don't know. Somebody once asked the Brisker Rav, how come the Litvisha don't study Kabbalah? So he said, who says they didn't study Kabbalah? He says, well, we never hear about it. He says, they didn't talk about it. You know, so you can't make any type of judgment. And whether he formally did or not, one has to believe that a Kodesh Baruch Hu gave him Siyata Dishmaya not to make an erroneous statement. So if indeed there would be something wrong with his psak al pisod, he wouldn't have said it.
Did the Ari, he wrote this, I don't understand, like the Nusach Ashkenaz, he had like notes on it that he would have in mind?
Yeah.
Did he actually say those things? He didn't say the Nusach part?
No, what I meant to say is the following. The Ari lived in Eretz Yisrael, and although, as I indicated, Ashkenaz was the original Nusach of Eretz Yisrael, but Lamaisa, the Jews who lived in Eretz Yisrael at the time were Sfardim, mainly. So the dominant Nusach in Eretz Yisrael was Eidot HaMizrach, which we call Nusach Sfarad, okay? Now, the Arizal wrote, actually he didn't write anything, his Talmud, Rav Chaim Vital, took notes of the Ari's teachings. And we have what are called the kavanos of the Arizal, which means on every word of the sitter, there'll be pages and pages of meditations, what it represents Kabbalistically. Now, people call this Nusach Ari, but it really wasn't Nusach Ari. In other words, the Ari just took his sitter and he wrote these, not he, but his Talmidim wrote kavanos on it. So you can buy a sitter with the kavanos of the Arizal, but like, you know, it'll be an amazing thing. It would take you, I mean, number one, if we wouldn't understand a single sentence of it, number one. And number two, even in kamas, even in quantity, it's pages, pages, pages. On the word Baruch, you know, it'll be 5 pages. Atah, 5 pages. Hashem, you know, 10 pages, you know, etc. So these are called the kavanos of the Ari. So what the Ari was mechadesh was not the nusach of the prayer, as people mistakenly think. He just took the sitter that he had, and he showed you the deeper Kabbalistic meanings of every single syllable. And the Chassam Sefer says, he would have done the same thing with an Ashkenaz sitter. That happened not to have been what he used. Does it make sense? Now, you can get this in writing. I mean, the Ari's Kavanas are written down. Although I'll tell you one beautiful thing the Arizal himself said. The Arizal himself said that the purpose of all of his elaborate, deep, complicated, lengthy Kavanas is that he should be able to daven to Hashem like a newborn baby cries for his mother. He says he just wants to get into the framework of total helplessness and his spotless to Hashem. Yeah. I'm sorry, yeah.
How did it result that certain Sfarim we have also in Gemaras, that certain Mepharshim made it onto the Daf and others did not? Basically, the Gemara Tosfos are like,
yes, it's a very excellent question, and the historical reason is it's simply printers who made the decision at various points. Sometimes they made the decision for religious reasons. It may have been a printer who was a Talmud Chacham, he decided this was a good perush. Sometimes it was for getting room on the page and what fits, you know. Remember, before there was computer layouts, the typography of a Talmudic page is quite complicated. What do you put in? How long do you make the Gemara, et cetera, to fit in all of the perush? It's really a remarkable example of hyperlinking and all of that stuff. Now, so in many, many ways, one would just argue, if you weren't a Maimon, that these are just arbitrary accidents based on the size of the page, the size of the text, and everything else. Different printers had different manuscripts at the time. In other words, some printer may have had Tosfos, but not the Rashba, and that's why the Rashba didn't make it, and then it became standard. In other words, they didn't have every manuscript of every commentary at the time. However, we do have to believe that there is no accident here, and that is, if HaKadosh Baruch Hu arranged it, that this was it, then we have to assume Al-Pi Hashgacha, HaKadosh Baruch Hu considered these to be the Perushim that are most helpful to understand the Gemara. Now, having said that, I've heard Gedolim say that they considered it to be a chaval that Tosfos is on the daf instead of the Rush. The Rush in the back of the Gemara would actually have been more helpful than Tosfos on the Gemara, because the Rush is a kitzer of Tosfos, and the Rush also gives you halacha lemaisa, or at least the beginnings of halacha lemaisa, or something like the Rambam on the side. Some Gemaras, although not the, this was abandoned a little bit because it got too unwieldy, so they don't do it in the new Shasas, but there was a time around 30 years ago, they tried to put the Rambam on the daf as well, on the side. But there really wasn't enough room, so they had to do half of it, and then you look to the back of the Gemara, like the art scroll things or whatever. So as I say, historically, it's a function of the printers, but spiritually, we have to assume there's Hashgacha Pratis in everything that happened. Yeah.
Let's learn how there can be a machlokas between authorities on history. For example, Vilna Gaon argues that Ahasuerus was not from a royal stock, but yet we learn that he was from royalty. How could he argue history?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And just to add to your question a little bit, when we have matters of halacha, somebody says mutter, somebody says usher, somebody says chayev, somebody says putter. So we have a mahalach that the Gemara calls Elu v'Elu Divrei Elokim Chayim. They're both right. Now, even that is a problem. How can they be both right if they say opposite things? But we have an explanation that as long as HaKadosh Baruch Hu's klalim are being used, Hashem gave principles, and then the different chachamim are using the principles and they come up with different conclusions, Hashem says, as long as it's based on the Torah Shebaal Peh, I will give it the imprimatur of correctness. So it's not a question of what did Hashem say. Hashem gave klalim, and the Chachamim use the Klalim to extract a conclusion. This is what the Drasha Saran says, is the idea that two mutually opposite opinions in Halacha, Hashem will say, whichever one you follow, if there's no majority that's poskening, will be Emes. But that can only work in a matter of Halacha, where Hashem didn't specifically say, you know, is surrogate motherhood okay, is cloning okay, HaKadosh Baruch Hu just gave me the Klalim, and then we come to different conclusions. But when it's a matter of historical reality, what happens 2,000 years ago, 3,000 years ago? Somebody says X, somebody says Y. Well, it either happened this way or it happened this way. So we would be forced to conclude that somebody is wrong. Now, there is such a possibility. Some Rishonim say, in matters of history, when there is a machlokes, somebody's making a mistake. We don't know which one necessarily, but somebody is making a mistake, and we don't always say Elu v'Elu Divrei Elokim Chayim on matters of Metzius, only on matters of Din, only on matters of Halacha. The Maral, however, has a different approach. The Maral has a very symbolic approach to things, in which he says that in these inyanim of history, it can also be multiple perspectives. Now, I have to go back and see exactly how the Maral deals with that, but what the Maral would say, I'm giving you a generic way of approaching it, is he would say that there were aspects of Ahasuerus' life that connect him to a royalty, and there are aspects of Ahasuerus' life in which he did not have the characteristics of royalty. So instead of simply saying he was a commoner or he was royal, the suggestion of this machlokas would be not even a machlokas, but rather emphasize different respects in which he was rooted in royalty and different respects not. That's what the Maral tries to do. In all of his Chidushim of Agadita, he tries to show that Chazal are never arguing about a Metzius, but rather they are expressing different reflections of a truth that combines both of these ideas. But you'd have to look from the Maral for a specific illustration of that. Yeah.
Wasn't sure. There a difference between some boards of kosher allow whiskies with are made in port and wine? What's the reasoning behind it? Because London basin said it's fine, but many others said it's not.
Yeah. The issue comes up with Scotch.
Yeah, Scotch whiskey.
Yeah, and the best Scotch is aged in oak barrels, and the oak barrels were coated with sherry or port. Now, sherry or port are wines, and that gives them a certain taste, a certain flavor, and that's supposed to improve the quality of the scotch. I think the single malt scotch, the more expensive scotch. I'm really very far from an expert in this area, but I had many people in my show who seemed to take a great fascination in these subjects. And one of the big controversies in the kosherist world is indeed whether this type of scotch is kosher. Now, again, the active ingredients in scotch are not per se treif. The malt, the barley is perfectly fine. But the problem is the wine, the sherry, and the port are non-Jewish wine, which rabbinically one is not allowed to drink. So the question becomes, when you age your scotch in these barrels, particularly if it's over a long period of time, there's going to be the absorption of the sherry or the port into the scotch, rendering it treif, right? That's going to be the halachic issue. So the poskim that matter, it's quite complicated issue. The basis of the heter is that there is much more than 60 times the volume of scotch to the little bit of sherry that goes into the scotch. As a result, we apply the principle of batel b'shishim, right? The same way, if a drop of milk falls into a big meat soup, As long as you have 60 times the meat to the milk, it is batel, it is nullified, and the whole meat remains parv. And this is not only meat and milk, but even if it would be chazer or something really, really treif. So by the same token, the sherry is going to be batel into the scotch, right? That's the hedger argument. The isser argument is, which is actually seems to be a stronger argument, is that bittul b'shishim works only because we're making the assumption that you cannot taste something if it's diluted in a ratio of greater than 60 to 1. Now, obviously, if you couldn't taste anything, what would be the purpose of doing it? In other words, obviously, the experts who are into scotch would discern that there is a difference between the sherry scotch and the non-sherry scotch. Otherwise, it was exactly the same. Why did they do it? So consequently, if the non-kosher ingredient is deliberately there to impart some type of taste, you cannot rely on the swara of bittul b'shishim. Now, Rav Moshe Feinstein had a well-known tshuva where Rav Moshe basically forbids the scotch that was aged in sherry casks, but he does acknowledge that the matirim do have a swara. So the story that's told is, it's an interesting story, the story that's told is that at a kiddush or something, somebody gave him a l'chaim to drink from that type of scotch, and he took a tiny sip for kavod abrios, not to embarrass the person. Rav Moshe took this little sip, even though Rav Moshe held that one should be machmeran. But that would be the machlokes. It's basically whether it's batul b'shishim or whether it wouldn't be batul b'shishim. Yeah.
Not the batul b'shishim heter.
Yeah.
For anything was only if it's b'yevet.
Well, yes, that's very true, but you have to know what we mean by bidyevet, meaning to say, I am not allowed to put milk into a meat soup and rely on shishim. But here, I am the scotch consumer. I didn't do it. The company did it. And the company didn't do it for purposes of nullification. The company did it for purposes of their own making their product. So in a sense, once it is mixed up, I'm allowed to eat it l'chatchila. In other words, when you say l'chatchila b'diyeved, that just means you're not allowed to deliberately put in the treif ingredient. But if the treif ingredient was put in, you are allowed to eat it even l'chatchila. Right? In fact, it's brought down in the Rishonim that if a person is such a tzaddik that he doesn't want to rely on bittul b'shishim and he says, I'm not going to eat it, he's actually an apikoros a little bit, because what he's saying is he doesn't believe Chazal that say Isser is batul b'shishim. Okay, that's a controversial halacha. Some people say, if I care, if I want to be machmir, you know, what's wrong? But others say it is bedavka wrong to be machmir if it is batul, because otherwise you're a kofir in Torah Shabbat Peh. It's a little reminiscent of a famous statement of the Baal Hamor. The Baal Hamor writes, if somebody doesn't eat chanin, sholot, hot food on Shabbos, we have to investigate whether he's an apikoros, because maybe he's not eating hot food because he's like the tzedukim who believe that even if you cooked before Shabbos, you weren't allowed to have anything hot. Yeah.
Are you allowed to scare people for fun?
Well, generally speaking, the answer would be no, but it kind of depends on your relationship. You can't scare people because you're getting fun out of it. But if by virtue of your friendship, you know that they would enjoy it after the fact, in effect, it's as if they gave you permission ahead of time to do it. But you have to be careful not to do, not to...
I jump it out from around the corner.
Yeah, but it's kind of... let me put it this way. If you know that they would enjoy the joke a second later, then in effect, it's as if they gave you permission. But otherwise, you shouldn't make that assumption. Well, Aramaic is a very, very ancient language. Aramaic was the language of Lavan. In fact, one could say Aramaic was the ancestral language of Avraham Avinu himself. When did he pick up Hebrew? It's not entirely clear to us. But Aramaic is an old language. And in fact, the Torah itself records some Aramaic words that Lavan used. If you remember, when Yaakov separates from Lavan, and they build a monument at the borderline, as if, say, none of us will ever cross over to hurt the other. So Yaakov called it Galed, which means in Hebrew, the pile of testimony. And Lavan called it Yagar Sahadusa, which is the same thing in Aramaic. Yigar Sahadusa means the Amud Sahadusa of Aegis. So Aramaic is a very old, is a very, very old language. Now, obviously, it is a Semitic language, so it does have much of the same structure as Hebrew. And, of course, there are different types of Aramaic. There's the Aramaic of Eretz Yisrael, which is the language of the Yerushalmi and the Medrash. And then there's the Aramaic of the Babylonian Talmud, which is Babylonian Aramaic. And those are different dialects. Those are, in fact, different dialects. That's why even if you knew how to read the Bavli, the language of the Yerushalmi, and it's not a different language, but the language of the Yerushalmi or the Medrash is rougher, you know, if you're not used to it, etc. But and when that split was, I don't know, but Aramaic is a language that the Torah itself refers to. So it's very old. By the way, I just want to say, the only native speakers, there are people who speak Aramaic even today. Aramaic is a dying language, except in learning. But there are villages of Christian Syrians who speak Aramaic. See, Aramaic was not like Yiddish. Yiddish was only spoken by Jews. Hebrew was only spoken by Jews, basically. Aramaic was spoken by all sorts of people, many of whom were not Jews. So you could actually, so if you have difficulty in Gemara, you can call up some woman in Syria, and she can tell you exactly, you know, exactly what the phrase is. The other group are the Kurds, which are the Jewish Kurds of Iran.
The what is it?
The Kurds. Oh, yeah. The Jewish Kurds of Iran, many of whom live here now, are Aramaic speakers. Yeah.
So was it always
did it
always use Hebrew letters?
No, no. That's interesting.
And the
Shorashim
as well, from Hebrew
language. Well, the Shorashim, you know, obviously if a word in Aramaic and Hebrew is the same word or the same structure, it could have the same Shorash. That's not a problem. All Semitic languages work with Shorashim. That's not even Assyrian or whatever it is. But the question you're asking is a good question. What was the Aramaic alphabet? It's not Hebrew. The Hebrew alphabet was just like Yiddish, right? Was written in Hebrew letters, but Yiddish didn't have its own alphabet. But Aramaic must have had an alphabet because there were non-Jewish speakers of Aramaic. Yeah, I don't know, but it was not a Hebrew alphabet. Yeah.
Regarding the whiskey and sherry casks,
yeah.
I understand that it's. The iser is based on the fact that you're not allowed to use bottled bashishim if you're going to get the flavor.
Yes.
Of
that's correct. Meal.
But what if the difference in flavor is not because the whiskey is taking on the flavor of the sherry, but is simply taking on a different flavor as a result of the presence of the sherry? For example, a chemical catalyst which speeds up a reaction, but is not itself used in the reaction.
Yeah, no, that's an excellent question, and that's actually part of the debate. Part of the debate is, do I say that we negate betel only when you can taste the non-kosher ingredient, or if the non-kosher ingredient is indirectly recognizable in the mixture by virtue of its being a factor in the enhancement of the taste? So you've hit it exactly on the nail. The nail on the head as to what the crux of the issue would be. Yeah.
How do you understand the explanation of Pinati's Prasha that the reason Aaron participated in the Chetah Eger is because he's afraid that the people involved in this would kill him?
Yes. So you're saying it seems like selfish, and after all, a person should be willing to give his life before idolatry?
No, it's a question from a different angle that it's such a holy nation and such a high madriga.
Well, how could he assume that they were going to kill him? How could he assume? Well, keep in mind, they already killed somebody, right? Remember, Chor is Aaron's nephew, so they killed him. He tried to stop it. So for Aaron to be afraid that they would kill him is not unreasonable in light of the fact that they already did it. Now, if you're asking me how could they do it, you know, that's always going to be a question. This is how could they build a golden calf? This is a generation that just came out of Mitzrayim, that saw the Ten Makos, that saw Kriyas Yamsuf. But the short answer is, if you remember with Avimelech, going back when Avram pretended that Sarah was his sister, and Avimelech gets sick and everything else, and then Avimelech says to Avram, why didn't you tell me? It was your wife, then nothing would have happened. And Avram said, there is no Yiras Elokim in this place. So I thought you would kill me if I would tell you the truth. And the Bali Musar point out that once you don't have Yiras Hashem, you know, we might think, oh, okay, I'm not from, I'm not Yiras Hashem, but I'm a civilized person. No, without Yiras Hashem, human beings can descend to any type of level. And that's what happened. Aaron sees a wildness. That's the lesson of the Torah. Parua. Parua means they're totally uncovered. They're wild. They're hefker. They're in a frenzy. And when they're in a frenzy, anything could happen, in spite of the miracles, in spite of Kriyas Yamsuf. By the way, the Medrash gives something very powerful. The Medrash says that it says in Eicha that if a Kohen and a Navi get killed in the same day, that's like an unforgivable Avera. Chur was a Navi. And Aaron is both a Kohen and a Navi. So if Aaron gets killed, see, in other words, it's not Aaron's selfish self-preservation. It's Aaron does not want them to fulfill the pasuk of the death of the Kohen and the Navi. That would have been in the unforgivable of Aaron. Yeah.
Once had a shir, I don't know if this is opinionated or halacha, but that sarcasm was actually forbidden. And I was wondering if there's halacha or an opinion on that. What's your opinion?
Well, I hope not, but okay. I once saw an article about, in one of the Or Sameach journals, by a very respected person, in which he was talking about a certain comedy routine was really amalek. I feel very bad because I actually had enjoyed that comedy routine. But anyway, but when the concept is, I mean, but there is some point about this. And whether we can talk about sarcasm being usher, you know, I don't think we can talk about it as usher, but we can talk about its destructiveness and the danger of it in Avodas Hashem. And really, this corresponds more or less with what Chazal called leitzonus. Now, leitzonus is cynicism, sarcasm, knocking things, and kind of putting a negative spin on things, maybe to get a laugh, to get a joke. And the Mesilas Yesharim has a very, very famous line. He says, leitzonus achas, one leitzonus, doche mea tochechos, can destroy the effect of 100 Musar Shmuzim. I mean, I'll give you an example. You can just imagine, this happens sometimes in high yeshiva high schools. Let's say you're building up, or maybe even here in our yeshivas, you're building up a roof, you had a Shabbos, right? You have a Malava Malka, and people are singing, and people are, you know, maybe people are even crying. They've really reached a very high moment. And then like somebody, like taking a prick to a balloon, somebody like makes some joke at the time. And that can destroy the whole mood. Certainly jokes have a place, and one should generally try to be a good humor. But there are times in which you're so changing the atmosphere of seriousness that you're not going to recapture it again. And that's kind of the danger of sarcasm. And also sarcasm, particularly when you have children, is very, very destructive in some ways, because let's say in Eretz Yisrael here, we have different issues that are coming up. We talk about that a lot. You know, Gedolim have different pronouncements. So a sarcastic person is going to look at everything with a cynical eye and say, "Oh, this is a power struggle here, and they're going for money here." And a child grows up hearing all of this, even in a very fine home. The child loses respect for his rabbeim, loses respect for Rosh Hashivas, loses respect for Gedolim. And of course, if you engage in that, you lose your respect for Gedolim and for Rosh Hashivas and the like. So I'm not going to make a categorical statement that, you know, every little sarcastic remark is an Isra D'oraisa. I mean, if you tell your kid whose room is messy, he says, "Hey, your room looks like, you know, whatever, you know, some little remark you make," I'm not going to say that that's usher. But the general attitude of sarcasm can often take away your sense of wonder and respect for Torah and for Kedusha. And therefore, it's something that one should minimize. I'll tell you a bit of an extreme story that illustrates this. They say, you know, Rabbi Akiva Eiger, everyone knows the great Rabbi Akiva Eiger. Rabbi Akiva Eiger's son was also a great gadol, Rav Shlomo Eiger. Pekka often quotes Rosh Shlomo Eger, that in the back of the Gemara, don't be confused, there is something called Gilyon Maharsha. Do you ever recall seeing that? So don't be confused. The Sefer that's called Gilyon Maharsha is not the same as the Maharsha. The Maharsha is Rav Shmuel Eliezer, who lived in the 1500s, and that's the famous Maharsha. The Gilyon Maharsha is Rav Shlomo Eger, Morena Rav Shlomo Eger, and he gives basically very interesting Mara Makomos and cross-references to Rishonim and Achronim in Rav Yimasechta. So the story goes that Rav Shlomo Eger was engaged to be married to a very chush of a family, and at the L'chaim, or the Vort, whatever they, the Tanayim, whatever they called it then, Rebbe Kiveger, who was very, very modest and humble, Rebbe Kiveger went over to the Mechutin and says, I hope my son finds favor in your eyes. So the Mechutin, I mean, it's not even such a funny joke, he says something like, the son is great, but we love the son even more than the Mechutin, more than Rebbe Kiveger. Rebbe Kiveger thought that there was some pagan in him, so he asked, please tell me, what avera did I do? Tell me if there's anything wrong, so I could be misakin. So the Mechutin was very amazed. He meant it as a little joke. And then he told Rebbe Kiveger, Chas v'shalom, I just made a joke. So Rebbe Kiveger says, Lake Sonas! He says, my son is not going to marry into Lake Sonas. And he broke off the shidduch. It's kind of an extreme situation. But this is the danger of the Lake Sonas. In fact, this was even the danger of the comedy routine that the author was connecting. And the reason he connected to Amalek is that Amalek is actually defined by sarcasm, cynicism, and leitzanus. See, Amalek is not, when you think about evil in the world, now evil can take different guises. Sometimes you think about the violent axe murderer who just wants to destroy. But then there's the cool, collected, cynical person who says, you have your opinion, I have my opinion, etc. And Amalek is not the axe murderer. Amalek is the cynic. Amalek is the lights. So there is something dangerous about it. Yeah.
Now, what's the reason that we keep certain, because there's Javan and the honors and pickles there? I know that's a misunderstanding, but what?
Again, it's an excellent question. People ask all sorts of questions about different gezeiros of the rabbis, of the Rabbanan, that the reasons don't seem to apply today that much. I'll give you one example. You could pick a million examples. Well, we cannot take aspirin on Shabbos for a minor headache. If you're seriously ill, that's a separate thing, because we are afraid, or Chazal were afraid, that you would grind your own medicines and you'd be doing a malacha, and therefore Chazal prohibit taking the medicine lest you make your own by desecrating Shabbos. So the question is, I'm not going to make my own aspirin on Shabbos. I don't even know how to make aspirin. I mean, I'm going to go in the back and grind up a plant, for aspirin. Like, why should we make, those gezeiros? Or Chazal say you're not allowed to go swimming on Shabbos lest you construct a raft. Well, once again, we technically wouldn't do that. Maybe we'll blow up an inner tube, but that's not necessarily even usher. So I'll give you two answers. One answer is, which may not be spiritually satisfying, but it is a technical answer, and that is, once a takana or a gezeira is made by the Sanhedrin, only a Sanhedrin has the power to repeal it. So as a result, what I could say is this: we're stuck. Now, that's not a spiritually good answer, because what that's acknowledging is, it really doesn't make sense, but I can't do anything about it. Okay? I mean, that may be some approach, that literally we don't have the koach to be mevatel the maisim of a Sanhedrin until we have a Sanhedrin. Which means, in other words, when we have a Sanhedrin, you can go there, give them a list of all the rabbinic laws you think don't make sense, and maybe they'll repeal it. Maybe yes, maybe not. So that's the practical answer. The theoretical answer, or the ruchniistic answer, has to be that, as Rav Dessler writes, in every gezeira, there are infinite reasons, or many, many reasons, why these gezeiras are necessary. Chazal may have revealed reasons that were applicable in their time and place. But the fact that they revealed something that was applicable in their time and place does not exhaust the many, many other reasons, some of which we don't even know. And as a result, we have to assume that if HaKadosh Baruch Hu was Megala his Torah through the activities of the Chachamim, their enactments are considered to be eternal. Or let me put it this way. Okay, I could even say it a little differently. I could say the Chachamim may have had something in mind. Maybe the Chachamim had a particular reason in mind. Yes. But the fact that Hashem has not given us back the Sanhedrin yet, Hashem is telling us that there are other reasons to keep this going. So I'm not necessarily suggesting the Chachamim had those other reasons in mind, although maybe yes. But I am suggesting that when you make a statement like, we can't do anything about it because there's no Sanhedrin, we then have to ask ourselves, but why didn't Hashem give us a Sanhedrin? The answer is Hashem wants these things to exist. I mean, let me give you maybe a more dramatic example. Yom Tov Sheni is a very good example. We had to keep 2 days of Yom Tov in Chutz La'aretz because we didn't know in Chutz La'aretz when Rosh Chodesh was decreed. Now, the question becomes, today we know, today we have calendars. And even when the Beis HaMikdash comes back, we're not going to have uncertainty because we're not going to have to wait for messengers to do the Pony Express from Yerushalayim. We're going to have faxes and emails. And unless after the internet, you know, who knows? Okay. Maybe that's the terror stuff. Right? Now, because people are asking, why do I keep Yom Tov Sheni? Because the Mikdash will come back and we'll be in a state of uncertainty. We'll have instantaneous communication. Okay. Shouldn't be like Sunday. Okay. Anyway, so the thing is, the explanation is this. In Sifrei Kabbalah, it's brought down that although the historical reason for 2 days of Yom Tov doesn't apply today, but in Ruchnius, God put us in a matzav where we can't change it because the neshamos of people in Chutz La'aretz need the extra day of Kedusha. Now, that wasn't why the Chachamim made the Takana to begin with, but that's why Hashem doesn't let us get out of that Takana. See? So that's kind of how you have to look at it. Yeah?
Could you please discuss birth control for parents who have children of each gender, or children of only one gender, or due to financial troubles, or emotional troubles, or any of that?
Well, you know, obviously this would be a very, very personal matter, and every family would present a different shaila on it. Let me just point out that the very first mitzvah of the Torah is to be pru urvu, be fruitful and multiply. Now, whether you actually do the mitzvah is up to Hashem, but one is mechuyev to try to have children. Ad kedei kach, that according to the Shulchan Aruch, a man that is capable of having children is not allowed to marry a woman that he knows is not capable of having children, if she had hysterectomy or something of that nature. In the time of the Gemara, that wasn't true because you could marry another wife. You could marry two wives. But today, we only get one wife, the Chayim Ravainu Gershom, unless you're Sephardic, you're not allowed to marry a woman who cannot have children. Now, the minimum number of kids you need to fulfill the mitzvah is one son and one daughter. So no matter how many sons you have, you've got to keep on going. No matter how many daughters you have, you've got to keep on going. One son, one daughter. Now, even after you have fulfilled the basic mitzvah, as you can imagine looking around in Yerushalayim, there is a mitzvah to try to have as large a family as you're able. However, we're going to see in Halacha, there's a sharp distinction before you were Mekayim Pru Urvu and after you were Mekayim Pru Urvu. In other words, you're much more lenient, in theory, once you have the son and the daughter. So birth control, therefore, is normally considered to be improper unless there are reasons. Now, the reasons can be health-related. I don't mean pikuach nefesh, but serious health. Economic factors alone are not a reason for birth control, but economic factors can easily slide into psychological anxiety and stress levels. So the anxiety and stress is indeed a factor, not the money itself, but the secondary effects and the like. So that has to be, you know, that has to be weighed. Now let me mention one controversial issue. There's one very big controversial issue here, and that is, what about the concept of spacing? What if I or a married couple feels that we just had a child, and we would like the child to have 2 or 3 years in which that's the only one that we're raising, or we're not going to have another new baby so this child can get the attention of a toddler. Is there such a concept as spacing, not for parental reasons, but spacing for the best interests of the child? This is a big, big machlokas. Rav Moshe Feinstein was totally against the concept. He said there was no heter of spacing, and as long as the mother's health is good, the fact that she seems overworked, that just means the husband should help her, find support systems, but you don't prevent children from being born. There are some poskim who take the position. They bring an interesting raya. In the time of the Gemara, nursing was typically 2 years. Right? A child would be nursed for 2 years. Now, if a mother is nursing a child 100% with no other added food, nursing is a natural contraceptive. So the question you might ask is, how could we permit a woman to nurse a child for 2 years? That's the same thing as her being on birth control for 2 years. The answer is, Chazal must have said that since nursing is so beneficial for the child, what the child needs overrides bringing new children into the world. That's the heter of nursing for 2 years. So they argue, even if the mother is not nursing, she's entitled to give the child at least 2 years before she gets pregnant. That's a very fascinating raya. So according to that heter, between children, that means even between the first and the second, so you haven't done pru or vu yet, there would actually be a heter of delaying pregnancy for up to 2 years based on the analogy to nursing, which would mean 2 years and 9 months till the next child is born. So there is such a heter. As I say, Rav Moshe Feinstein was against the heter, but it is something to consider. Another issue that comes up, which is really a sad issue, but it does come up, and that is sometimes a married couple might not be getting along very well. There might be a lot of bitterness, but might be machlokas. It may not be so clear that the marriage will survive. Maybe they already have a child, and maybe they don't have a child. The question is, when they're still struggling in Shalom Bayis, do we basically say, full steam ahead, you know, mitzvah to have children? Or do we basically advise them that until the marriage is in a stronger footing, it would not be right to bring a child into the world if there's going to be a divorce, you know, 6 months later? Now, people sometimes mistakenly think when they have marital trouble, oh, once we have a child, the child will bring us together. Unfortunately, that's usually not the case. A child is a great bracha. Of course it's a great bracha. But it's also a great source of stress. It's a source of stress economically, emotionally, physically, and the like. So if a marriage is not a good marriage, having a child is usually not going to make it better. It may make it worse. So as a result, the common practice among Rabbanim and Morei Torah is that we will encourage contraception if a marriage is on very, very rocky and unstable grounds. But some poskim don't even allow that. Some poskim say, got to go ahead. So I would say that the three basic considerations for contraception are, number one, the physical health of the mother. Number two, the machlokas about spacing for the benefit of a child. And number three, when the marriage itself is on shaky foundation. Now, there's a secondary question, which isn't so important for me to get into in detail, and that is, even if there's a heter for contraception for, let's say, 6 months at a time or 2 years at a time, whatever it would be, there is then an issue of method, because keep in mind that certain methods of contraception are violative of masturbation or hashchasas zera. So, for example, a condom would not be permitted. In other words, you'd have to have a method of contraception that does not interfere with the physical sexual act. That is why the birth control pill is the best form of permissible contraception, because that inhibits ovulation, but that does not impede the passage of the zera. However, again, it's not no gas any of you yet, the halakhic problem with the birth control pill is it does have a side effect which to a non-religious person is almost nothing, but to a religious person it's very catastrophic, and that is it causes minor spotting in between menstrual periods. Not a little spotting, no big deal. Problem is, those little drops of blood can render a woman anita, so she could be anita, like, you know, for months at a time. So that has to be very carefully monitored. That's a serious problem with that. Yeah.
Sir, I'm not sure if you answered it already. What would a newly married couple, very, very young as well,
yep,
do if they, let's say, just said, okay, well, we'd like a year and a half just to get our lives together, our jobs together?
Yes, yes, yes. Right, so that's a common issue. Yeah. So here is the thing. That type of attitude, listen, we would certainly listen to it and talk to them about it, but that type of attitude generally we would try to discourage, meaning to say the message that a new couple has to hear, assuming that they're committed to each other and they're not fighting all the time, is that Hashem will give you the strength to do what you need to do. Before you have a child, it looks scary, it looks frightening, it looks impossible. It's like, we'll never be able to do it. And, you know, not everybody gets pregnant, you know, right away. The truth of the matter is, it's like a needle in a haystack. For one sperm to hit the egg, you know, it's very, very difficult. Every time it happens, it's a miracle. So, if you feel you really can't handle it, then Hashem won't give it to you. And if Hashem gives it to you, you'll be able to handle it. And what you have to do is you have to build a couple up. They have to talk to young friends that are having children. Remember, this married couple are not the first people who are young marrieds having children. It's been done before. I taught in a law school for many years. And, you know, I had students that got married and they would bring their babies to class and everything else, et cetera. So the point basically is, instead of just looking at somebody and saying, oh, you're overstressed, okay, birth control. You kind of work with them and say, what are the resources that's available? What are the things that make you nervous? What are the things that you're worried about? What can we do as a community to help? What friends are there? And husbands need to take a role in that too, even if it involves, you know, some bittul Torah in terms of doing what their wife needs when they have a child in the life. So I think overall, we do try to encourage people to recognize that if you're ready to get married, you are ready to have a child. But indeed, if there's an unusual level of anxiety and fear, then halacha would permit some deferral. Yeah.
If we're saying that Hashem will give a young couple the strength to do what they need to do, even if they don't feel that strength when they initially get married,
right,
then shouldn't that line of reasoning also be applied to all other situations, such as financially induced psychological stress or a rocky marriage, which is on the brinks, and then say, oh, listen, you know, it looks bad now, but Hashem will give you the strength.
Well, indeed, you know, some rabbis have taken that position, and sometimes it hasn't worked out that well. I mean, you know, there is a Hashem will take care of everything. But I think like this. I think it then turns into something similar to an illness. You know, by an illness, you are mechuyev to take steps like going to a doctor and the like. So when you're confronted with an existing situation of extreme stress and anxiety that cannot be assuaged by giving you chizuk and the like, then I think, according to the Torah, you are mechuyev to take the steps that will remove or mitigate or minimize or reduce some of the stress levels that will enable you to function. So at a point at which it really is a difficult situation, you get certain chiyuvim of hishtadlus that might not otherwise exist when it's not. In other words, you don't simply say Hashem will take care of it if indeed you're not in a situation right now where, you know, you have those abilities. So I would analogize it to the need to, when do you need to go to a doctor and when do you rely on bitachon? It's a kind of a similar thing to that. Yeah.
I was wondering if the Rebbe could tell us, when davening, what should our focus be? Being the kind, like all the halakhos of davening, or actually like creating that personal connection with Hashem?
Well, obviously it has to be both. Now you are highlighting an idea, which is an interesting problem. That is, sometimes when you're fixated on every tiny little detail of the halakha, you might lose the larger picture of being connected to Hashem. And there's kind of a contradiction sometimes, because when you lose yourself in tefillah, maybe you're less aware of all of the prete halachas. So that is a challenge. And that's why, you know, you try to learn the halachas enough so they're second nature, so you don't really have to consciously think about it. So you shouldn't, in other words, when you're davening, you shouldn't have to be consciously thinking about the Mishnah Berurah. But the hope would be that you've internalized it enough that it becomes relatively second nature. And at that point, your main point is to have a relationship with Hashem, to talk to Hashem, to speak to Hashem, to imagine, and sound imagination is true, that you're standing in front of the Almighty and He wants to hear from you. And, you know, that should be your main kavanah. But you do need to be sure that you are keeping the halachas, but as I say, that should be something you've already internalized beforehand.
A basic example is many people here daven very, very long. So if you're in a minion, like a dafka minion 10 on the nose, you know, you can't hold that at sibor. So to what extent do you play that off?
Oh, okay. So you're asking a different question. You're asking, should I compromise my religious fervor in the interests of the tzibur or the minyan or the like? Well, all I can tell you is that I've seen precedents with great gedolim. It's the Gemara itself. The Gemara says Rabbi Akiva. When Rabbi Akiva was davening the Yechidus, he davened very long, and when he was davening b'tzibur, he davened short. There is a concept of not being matriyach tzibur. That is very, very important. And one should not be a tzaddik on other people's cheshbon. Now, the other thing to know is, every person is different. But davening slow doesn't necessarily mean more kavana. Speed of davening, there is a context. In fact, some have said the opposite. Some say when you daven slowly, your mind tends to wander because you're not focusing on a sentence. Let's say, Baruch, you know. Okay, Ato, you know. Again, people are different in their styles, but some people actually feel they can have more kavanah if they say a whole sentence, a whole unit, etc. And that's why there were great tzaddikim who davened very, very quickly. The Belzer Rebbe, I understand, davened very, very quickly. The Ger Rebbe's davened very, very quickly because they feel that there's like a fire in their tefillah, and they can just do more enthusiasm and the like. So that's another thing. So you might want to experiment, meaning to say, it may not be, davening more quickly may not be at the loss of kavanah. It just may be a different way of having kavanah. Actually, it's interesting. Rav Perlman told me a story that he was once in the Mir Beis Medrash Friday afternoon. Nobody was there. But for some reason, Rav Chaim Shmulevitz, the great Rashiva, walked in to daven mincha b'yechidus. He didn't daven mincha yet. And Rav Chaim was like 10 feet from him. So Rav Perlman could actually hear Rav Chaim davening. So when it came to Atah Chonein, the blessing for wisdom, Rav Chaim was saying it so slowly, and he would also interpose, like in Yiddish phrases, Tatza, please, you know, give me knowledge and understanding. And Mamish, it took him like 5 minutes for Atah Chonein. Then Rav Perlman said, the rest of Shmon Esrei took like 30 seconds. He doesn't even know how fast he was able to read it. He just took 3 steps back, you know. So again, apparently you selectively focus sometimes on what's the icker thing for you, you know. Yes.
I'm just wondering about Tehillim, because there's different prakim that are attributed to different people, and there are some prakim that talk about, you know, the destruction based on Mikdash. So the question is, were there many authors together, or was there one author? And at what stage was the
healing
completed?
Yeah. This is clear that one shouldn't assume that if there's multiple authors of Tehillim, there's Apikorsis or Kefira. I mean, the Gemara itself says that Tehillim has no fewer than 10 authors. Moshe Rabbeinu was in there, Tefillah LeMoshe. Mizmor Shir LeYom HaShabbos is attributed to Adam HaRishon. Now, with respect to the Tehillim that talk about the Chorban, or even the return, right? Shir HaMalos, the famous Shir HaMalos we say before benching. B'Shuv Hashem Eshiv HaSiyan, when we returned to Tzion, we were like dreamers, right? I mean, that was written after the Chorban and after the 70 years of God. Well, it's referring to that situation. How do you understand that? So there are two interpretations. Some of Farshim learn that those were written by David HaMelech with Ruach HaKodesh or Nebuah. So even the future ones were authored by David. Other Mefarshim say no. If once Chazal tell me that there are Kapitlach of Tehillim that were written by later authors, then why can't I assume this too? So when we say Tehillim was authored by David HaMelech, that just means David HaMelech was the predominant author, and other things were added from other groupings. Mishlei is the same thing, by the way. In Mishlei, the Gra says, although the book of Mishlei, Proverbs, is attributed to Shlomo HaMelech, in fact, we have Proverbs from a king that is called Lemuel, and Ogur ben Yochanan, and other people there. And the Gra says, now, some of Farshim say these are pseudonyms for Shlomo. But the Gra says, no, they weren't pseudonyms. But rather, they were added to Mishlei because they were other collections of Proverbs. Now, who did this compiling? Who compiled it? So this was actually the work of the Anshei Knesset HaGdola. In other words, after the Babylonian exile, when the Jews came back, so there was a group under the leadership of Ezra and Nehemiah, 120 elders, and they did a lot of stuff. They wrote the Siddur, they wrote the Shemona Esrei, they wrote all of these things. And they were the ones who canonized Kisvei HaKodesh. They did the final compilation of what was considered to be Kisvei HaKodesh because they were the last prophets. Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi were the last Nevi'im at the beginning of the Bayis Sheni. They were the members of the Anshei Knesset HaGdola, and they declared what Sforim are in Tanakh and what are not. And they made these final collections.
I was just wondering, how should one treat instructions from a Gadol? The example that I have in mind is, I know of a Bachur who went to a Gadol, and the Gadol said something, but in addition, grow your beard. Now, that's not strictly required by halacha, so it's not like saying keep Shabbos. That would be kosher. But it's do this above and beyond thing. The way this strikes me is that the Gadol has only met whoever the Bachur is, once, a few minutes.
Yeah.
And is issuing an instruction, not knowing the Bachur's situation, and maybe the Bachur will have to shave it off for work. So how should one treat such instructions? Yes, he's a Gadol, but how? What authority? What position are they in to be issuing an instruction like that? For someone who they've met for about a minute.
Well, it really depends on how the Gadol said it. You know, if the Gadol said, you are chayav to grow a beard, you must grow a beard, then you should listen to it. But on the other hand, I doubt that that's the way it was said. It was probably said.
It was not the way it was said.
So the Gadol is basically, I think, communicating an idea, not a directive. The Gadol is basically saying, growing a beard is an important thing, and I want you to realize it's an important thing. Now, it then has to be balanced with other things. And I don't think the Gadol meant to preempt consultation with Rebbeim that know the person better and consideration of other situations. He wanted the Bachur to absorb an idea that a beard is an important thing in Torah. It's not just an optional type of thing. Okay, so you have to take it with a grain of salt, not in the sense that it's not important, but in the sense that the Gadol is adding a factor to the spiritual mix of this person that then has to be weighed with many other things as well. And I think the Gadol himself would acknowledge that. Okay, now, if the Gadol gave him an order, that's a separate thing, but then I would question whether he was a Gadol, because Gadolim don't talk that way. Gadolim just emphasize, what's important, and then they leave it to the person, particularly the literature Gadolim, they leave it to the person to see how that should apply in his own life.
The reason I'm a little concerned is because a Bachur in such a situation might, a year down the line, upon entering the workforce, wonder, oh my goodness, should I cut this off, or should I trim it, or...
Well, I think that he should wonder, meaning to say the following. I don't see that as such a bad thing that he should agonize over it. In other words, the Gadol is telling him, having a beard is important. Now, it's not the most important thing, and it may have to yield to other considerations, but just know that by giving it up, you're giving something up. I mean, that's not all bad, that if a person has to shave his beard, he should feel, a little worried about it, because it is something to be concerned about, But all I'm saying is, the Gadol did not mean to make a veto that he could not shave off his beard. Yeah.
In Chuskel Arutz, some have different opinion, or there are different opinions, whether to wear tefillin during Chol Hamoed. What are the basis for the different opinions, and how does that apply?
Well, the basic opinions are this. All of us know that we do not wear tefillin on Shabbos and Yom Tov. That's absolutely clear, and that's no machlokas about that. So the machlokas is how much of a Yom Tov is Chol HaMoed. And it's based on different Gemaras. Some opinions say that since Chol HaMoed is forbidden in some malachos, and some say Minat Torah, it has the holiness of a Yom Tov, and therefore Tefillin does not apply. Others say the fact that Chol HaMoed is permitted in some malachos means it doesn't have the holiness of a Yom Tov. So as a result, in Chutz La'aretz you're going to find different kehilos. The actual Ashkenazic minhag is to wear tefillin on Chol HaMoed, some with a bracha, some without a bracha, but they take it off before Hallel. Unlike Rosh Chodesh, which is after Chol HaMoed, before Hallel, Svardim and Chassidim, following the Arizal, do not wear tefillin Chol HaMoed. And many people in Ashkenazic shuls, whose parents come from Poland and Galicia, do not wear because they're actually Hasidim, even though they don't know it, even though they're regular Ashkenazim, but they come from Hasidish families. Now, in Eretz Yisrael, virtually, at least Yerushalayim, virtually the universal minhag is not to wear tefillin, not because of Eretz Yisrael per se, but because this was the minhag of both the Sfardim that were here and the Talmidei Hagra, right? So this is a rare combination of where Ashkenazim and Sfardim, who came to Eretz Yisrael, had the same minhag. Now, if you go up to Haifa, maybe other places too, where you have like old German kehilas, there are pockets that wear tefillin Chol HaMoed. But it's really very, very small, the overwhelming minhag. So it's brought down in Sfarim that even if your minhag in Chutz La'aretz was to wear Chol HaMoed, in Eretz Yisrael you shouldn't. But some say you do it privately. Just put it on before davening, take it off, and then daven without.
And then a follow-up to that would be, if you acquire your minhag, a lot of people will become Baal Shuvahs when they first come to Eretz Yisrael, and yep. For the minhag is not, when you go back to Chutz La'aretz.
You have no reason to change, because you're following you've learned a minhag that is a legitimate minhag in Chutz La'aretz too. The only thing that one might consider is this, in Chutz La'aretz, there's a tremendous zilzul in Kedushas Chol HaMoed. In other words, in Chutz La'aretz, people treat Chol HaMoed like a weekday. They don't have a sense of Kedusha. In Eretz Yisrael, one of the things, at least in Yerushalayim, one of the things you see is Chol HaMoed is really a yom. If you want to buy a sefer at Chol HaMoed, the bookstores are closed and the like. So to me, it always grates me a little bit that, hey, you don't wear tefillin because it has the same kedusha as Yom Tov, but then you write, and in other words, it's a mudna thing that the way you choose to emphasize the holiness of Chol HaMoed is by not wearing tefillin, but you do everything else. It would seem it's a kal v'chomer. If I treat it as so kadosh that I don't wear tefillin, then how much more so must I treat it like a Yom Tov with respect to Divrei Chol? So I think that would be the good attitude. But if you're mezalzel b'Chol HaMoed and you don't treat it with kedusha, then it's not so clear to me that you should take on the meaning of that wearing tefillin. Yeah.
How does a Baal Shuva choose his authority, and specifically in the Osamat world, besides you?
I told you, no legs on it, I told you. Yeah.
Well, how who do we go back to look at? Like, if we, let's say, we don't know our family or what else we talk.
So here you really have a lot of free rein, because like this, sometimes people say, oh, well, if my great grandparents came from Germany, I got a yucky minhagim. If my great grandparents came from Poland, that's not true. The good news is, once there's a break in that mesorah, once there's a break, you're new, just like a person who's a ger is new. A ger does not have to follow any family minhagim. Even if his father was Jewish, he wouldn't have to follow his father's minhagim in any way. So in a sense, you have the choice, and since if you're still in exploration, your choice is not necessarily final. But the hadracha basically is that you should eventually connect. Now, you can't pick and choose like a Chinese menu. I like Spartan Friday nights, but you choose based on, I hate to use this subjective term, but it is based on where you're comfortable. I mean, every neshama, I don't mean physical comfort, but every neshama gets aroused in a different way. And you try to find out, what are those things that make me feel close to HaKadosh Baruch Hu? This may be a function of the overall minhag, or it may be a function of a particular Rebbe. Sometimes you may not like the Rebbe's minhag, but you love the Rebbe. All right, so it may be Kedai to say, he's my Rebbe, I want to connect to him, even though some of the stuff is a little hard for me. So sometimes it's the beauty and power of the minhag, and sometimes it's the beauty and power of the person, and sometimes it's the chaverim, and sometimes it's the yeshiva. But all of these are relevant factors. Establishing what kehila you want to become a part of is really a shidduch. It really is a shidduch. It's the same as a marriage, and it's as complicated as a marriage. But you know, you have freedom. What I can tell you is that I don't know if that makes it easier or harder. You know, you have the freedom, which of course, in a sense, makes it a little harder. Yeah.
Well, on that same issue, when you say a bit of freedom, but you kind of stick to find a community that you feel comfortable with. To what extent is it sticking to that community? What extent can you still kind of You like this community, but there's maybe one or two, not necessarily major things like kidneys or whatever, but smaller things that you might have a little bit more plied with.
Well, you're allowed to. I mean, let's say you're a Litvak, and there's a particular Hasidic minhag of, I don't know, lighting candles Moshe Shabbos at Amalav Malka. Litvaks don't do it, Hasidim do it. You want to do it. Go ahead and do it. In other words, it's perfectly okay to incorporate minhagim that don't involve prohibitions or the like. See, some of that tefillin, kidneys, these are major issues because you're either chayav to wear tefillin or you're forbidden to wear tefillin. So you can't like optionally decide I want to go one way or the other. You have to be consistent. But there are many, many beautiful minhagim that are really optional minhagim in the sense that if you do it, you're doing nothing wrong, but if you don't do it, you're doing nothing wrong. And you can decide that this enhances your derech avoda. So you're allowed to incorporate those minhagim. That's perfectly fine. Yeah.
I'd like to ask a follow-up question to the birth control question.
Yeah.
Isn't authorizing birth control for a couple under financially induced psychological stress simply acquiescing to the yesir hara? Because where does that stress come from? A lack of avoda, yesir hara?
Well, you're 100% correct, and part of the hadracha is to help them build emunah. 100% correct. That's what I'm saying. The first response is not, oh, you're stressed, let's have birth control. But here's the problem. You know, you have to remember, I'll go back to the idea of not being a tzaddik on somebody else's cheshbon. That is, I can tell a husband and a wife, you know, overcome your stress. But they're planning, you know, if they're going to bring a child into the world, you know, I can't necessarily rely on what they should do to assume that they will do it, and you know the child may suffer as a result. You know, so you have to keep that in mind that there is going to be another person here, and therefore you have to look at it that way. But you're 100% correct. You know, I'm sure many of you have heard of Rabbi Shalom Arush. We have the Breslov Yeshiva down the road, Chut Shel Chesed. So Rabbi Arush has become, especially in English translation, a best-selling author. He's written the marriage manuals and for men. By the way, the men's manual, a woman is not allowed to read, and the woman's manual, a man is not allowed to read. I was curious. I stayed in New York. They actually had both volumes, so I was able to look at both volumes. it is very interesting. The man's manual says, if anything goes wrong, it's your fault. Don't complain about the other person. And the woman's manual says, if anything goes wrong, it's your fault. Don't complain about the other person. So in a way, it makes a lot of sense, meaning each person should never blame the other person. Each person should take full responsibility for everything, which, you know, actually, it's not that's not a bad approach in many ways. But his big thing, and he's right, actually, his big thing is that if a person really has emunah, there's a catch-22 about emunah. The stronger your emunah, the more Hashem's divine providence is going to be manifest in your life. So you're 100% correct that the shmuz that one gives to a married couple is emunah in God, emunah in yourself, that Hashem will give you the ability. But as I say, you know, if people are not responding, you can't just assume they're going to be tzaddikim when it comes to the life of another child that's going to come into the world. Okay, I will take one more. Yeah.
Is there a concept of the neshama getting cut off after it's been like secularized over like a period of time?
Well, if you mean, is there a time at which tshuva becomes impossible, I would say not. I would say that, first of all, we've seen in our own lives, in our own times, we've seen Jewish people who have been separated from the Jewish people for many, many years, some of whom have become Christians, etc., and they found their way back in various ways. So we believe that a soul always has the potential to come back to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Now, if the soul doesn't do it, it'll keep on coming back. That's called reincarnation. Now, the Gemara doesn't mention reincarnation, to be sure, but the Mekubalim say there's going to be repetitive Gilgulim. So Hashem will not allow a soul to be totally, totally cut off. Okay, I'll take care. Take care. Yeah, but, by the way, I was too harsh. I don't want to be overly harsh on your host.
I'm sure they're very kind here.